Tehran and Muscat signed several documents to boost cooperation as the Sultan of Oman pays a two-day state visit to Iran. The Turkish president calls for unity after winning the runoff vote as the defeated opposition leader complains of what he calls the most unfair election in recent years. And Syria says it has confronted an Israeli missile strike on the outskirts of Damascus, the first such attack on the capital city since late March. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Muse. It's good to have you with us. The Iranian president and the Sultan of Oman have called for closer cooperation in different areas after they met in Tehran. President Ebrahim Raisi says bilateral ties are now at the investment phase. Raisi is calling for cooperation on commerce, energy, defense, and security. He is also hailing the approach of the Saudis to regional cooperation and the strengthening of regional peace and security. The Sultan of Oman echoed Raisi. He said Iran and Oman have high potential for further trade, even as their economic exchanges have doubled since last year. Haytham bin Tariq is in Iran on a two-day state visit. Following the negotiations between the two leaders, Iranian and Omani foreign ministers held a joint presser on the agreements reached between the two sides.
The documents, which focus on cooperation in the fields of energy, investment, free zones, as well as in the areas of industry. We both agree that a document called Comprehensive Strategic Cooperation between the two countries should be signed between the two sides in the near future.
Iran's foreign minister added that other issues were also discussed by the two leaders, namely the transit of goods, the Ashgabat Agreement, as well as quadrilateral transit deal between Iran, Oman, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. He said closer cooperation among regional countries was also emphasized during the talks between the two leaders. The Omani foreign minister in turn noted that the two sides reached good agreements in a bid to further enhance their age-old relations. Iran and Oman have maintained cordial ties throughout the years and have recently stepped up efforts to strengthen the partnership. Earlier, we were joined by John Ross, who is a senior fellow at Chungang Institute for Financial Studies in China. He explained the importance of the Iranian visit by the Sultan of Oman.
Well, I think it's both the importance of the individual visit, but it's also a tendency of a whole trend which is taking place, particularly in West Asia, but it's taking place in other parts of the world at the present time, which is a number of countries are strengthening their cooperation and deciding they don't want to pursue policies of de facto of the United States of isolating countries like Iran or China or Russia. I thought there was a very interesting article which appeared in the Financial Times called the Hour of the Global South, by which it meant not merely developing countries, I think, but also a political thing, that an increasing number of countries are refusing to go along with the attempts of the United States to unilateral impose things on the world. So I think it's both an important visit in itself, and it also is part of a trend which is going on in the world, and that's why it attracted so much attention.
The Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wins re-election in Sunday's runoff vote, extending his rule into his third decade. With over 99% of the ballot boxes opened, Erdogan garnered more than 52% of the votes. His rival Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu received nearly 48%, trailing Erdogan by more than 2 million votes. The country's Supreme Election Council says the uncounted ballots will not change the results. After he was declared the winner, Erdogan addressed a crowd of his supporters outside of the presidential palace in the capital, Ankara. He called on Turks to unite in favor of the country's national goals.
It's time to unite and unify around our national goals and national dreams, leaving aside all discussions and disputes regarding the election period.
Erdogan also says the election is Turkey's most important in the modern era, adding the entire nation is the winner. The opposition leader, Kılıçdaroğlu, has not explicitly conceded defeat. He says the election was the most unfair in recent years and that Erdogan's party mobilized all the means of the state against him. However, he thanked people who voted for him. Well, in the meantime, congratulatory messages are pouring in for the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan over his election victory. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has passed on his good wishes to Erdogan, saying that his victory shows the Turkish people's continued trust in him. Raisi expressed hope that the two countries' bonds of friendship will be strengthened, that the close cooperation will help promote regional peace and stability. The Russian President Vladimir Putin also commended Erdogan, whom he called his dear friend. Putin said Erdogan's victory is a proof that the Turkish people support his efforts to strengthen sovereignty and to pursue an independent foreign policy. The EU Council President Charles Michel said that he looks forward to working with Erdogan to deepen EU-Turkey relations. The Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, as well as the Hamas resistance movement, hailed Erdogan's victory. France, the US, the UK, Germany, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, and Ukraine have also congratulated Erdogan. Israeli forces have killed two Palestinians and injured eight others with live fire during fresh raids in the occupied West Bank. Let's cross on over to occupied Ramallah. Our correspondent Mona Kandil joins us with more details. Mona, what do you have for us?
Palestinian city at this morning and used their weapons during an air raid operation, wounding at least eight Palestinians. One of them was in serious condition. After the incursion to Jenin has ended, the Palestinian 37-year-old Palestinian Ashraf Ibrahim succumbed to his injury. Palestinian paramedics say that Ashraf Ibrahim was shot in the abdomen and the chest. Then he succumbed to his injuries. Ashraf Ibrahim, 37-year-old from Jenin, was an officer in the Palestinian security forces, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. During the operation, six other Palestinians were arrested by the Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military issued a statement saying that has been under fire with Palestinian fighters. Hurled explosive devices towards the Israeli forces in raiding Jenin city, and that the Israeli troops had confiscated a number of Palestinian arms and weapons, as well as other military equipment in the city of Jenin. Israeli military also said that six other Palestinians had been arrested in other areas of the occupied West Bank, and they claim that those who were detained, not in Jenin, in other areas of the occupied West Bank, are involved in anti-Israeli operations, that they had took part in shooting towards Israeli settlers and Israeli forces, and that those were planning to carry out anti-Israeli operations.
Thank you very much for that. That's Mona Kandil, correspondent from occupied Ramallah. Thank you, Mona. Well, the Israel regime has carried out yet another airstrike on Syria, this time targeting positions in the capital, Damascus. A number of explosions were heard shortly before midnight local time. The Syrian military says the country's air defenses responded to the attacks using anti-aircraft. It says the attacks only caused some material damage. The strikes were the first on Damascus since late March. The last Israeli raid on Syria in early May left seven people dead in the northwestern city of Aleppo. The Israeli regime routinely carries out airstrikes on Syria. Syrian officials have, for a number of times, called on the UN to force the Israeli regime to stop its aggression. They say the move is in violation of international law. Of course, Mohammed Mohammad Ali joins us now from Syria's capital, Damascus, to tell us more. Mohammed, tell us what has occurred in terms of these strikes.
Yes, a new Israeli aggression was carried out yesterday, last night, according to an official Syrian military source. At about 11:45 p.m. Last night, Israeli fighter jets targeted several positions around the capital, Damascus, firing a number of missiles. The residents of Damascus heard the sounds of Syrian air defenses intercepting that attack. Several enemy missiles were shot down. However, it seemed that some of them did reach some targets because the Syrian military source said that the attack resulted in material damage. Now, no one was killed or injured, and definitely this is not the first attack of its kind. We don't know for sure or in particular what was exactly targeted, but it seems that there were some military positions for the Syrian army around the Syrian capital. The Israeli side, as usual, did not comment on the issue, but tens, if not hundreds, of attacks by Israel have been carried out since the start of the crisis. And the Syrian government, especially the foreign ministry officials, always stress that those attacks are in direct support of the remaining terrorist groups in Syria. It's also worth mentioning that every time there has been a military advancement for the Syrian army against terrorists on the ground, we used to see similar Israeli attacks, and those attacks this time come following political achievements for Syria, especially following Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's presence in the Arab League summit, following the reconciliations from the Arab world with Syria. So some analysts believe that those attacks are actually in direct support of those remaining terrorist groups in Syria, that Israel's wanted to say to them that we are still backing you.
Thank you very much for that. We appreciate it. Mohammed Ali, a correspondent there from Damascus. For decades, the Hannibal Directive has been one of the most controversial and mysterious procedures in the dark history of the Israeli military. The Hannibal Directive is an order that is used to prevent the capture of Israeli soldiers by enemy forces, even at the cost of the soldier's life. Now, with the development of social media, the directive is becoming more challenging for the regime in Tel Aviv.
The Hannibal Directive, that's the name for one of the most dramatic and controversial murky procedures in the history of the Israeli military. In terms of what it signifies, it's an order that mandates the Israeli army to kill its own troops rather than allowing them to be taken as captives. The order was drafted in mid-1986, just months after the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah captured two Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon. It clearly stated that in case of capture, the main mission becomes rescuing soldiers from the camp at the cost of hitting or wounding the soldiers. Now, nearly four decades after, the measure is becoming challenging for Tel Aviv to conceal its combat-related deaths. According to an article published by online news magazine The Cradle, during the recent five-day Israeli aggression on Gaza, there was renewed controversy over the regime's refusal to acknowledge its human losses in military conflicts with Palestinian resistance forces. The Cradle says Palestinian fighters launched over 1,500 missiles targeting approximately 80 cities and towns. Some of the missiles struck crowded neighborhoods in Ashkelon, Tel Aviv, Ramla, causing significant destruction. Although reports circulated about dozens of deaths and injuries, with eyewitnesses describing scenes of utter devastation, the only published image was the one showing a deceased individual in a settlement near Tel Aviv. Later, Israeli officials admitted the killing of a Jewish settler and a foreign worker, while claiming 74 others were wounded. 1 month prior to the Israeli-Gaza onslaught, Palestinian and Israeli media reported Israel's admission of four officers having been killed in a 2014 operation carried out by Hamas military arm, the Al-Aqsam Brigades. During the operation, the Qassam fighters infiltrated a site near an Israeli settlement in northern Gaza Strip through a 3-kilometer tunnel. Israeli officials initially claimed that the soldiers had neutralized all 12 attackers and did not disclose any casualties among its own ranks.
The Israeli regime has for decades refused to acknowledge its human losses from Palestinian resistance operations. This includes losses caused by anti-Israeli operations, as well as soldiers killed under the Hannibal Directive. Yet the Israeli army maintains the policy of denial or misinformation.
The Israeli regime has a long history of refusing to acknowledge its human losses from Palestinian resistance operations, particularly among its own military personnel. For decades, the regime has been promoting the notion to its adversaries that its soldiers do not die in warfare, but facts on the ground prove otherwise. In November 1982, Palestinian resistance fighter Ahmed Qasir carried out an operation at an Israeli military headquarters in southern Lebanon. Up until today, the regime has refused to admit that the bombing claimed the lives of 141 of its soldiers. Now, decades after the incident, the regime still falsely attributes the explosion to a gas leak or a structural error that led to the building collapse and refuses to acknowledge that despite convincing evidence, it was in fact a suicide bombing that caused the explosion. Ever since that bombing, numerous incidents have happened with Israeli officials maintaining the policy of refusal and misinformation regarding its troop losses. In May 2022, a former Israeli minister disclosed that Officer Barak Sharabi from the Sayeret Matkal unit was killed in an operation in Syria in 1984, contrary to claims by authorities that he died in a car accident. Another one in the year 2021, when Israeli archive disclosure revealed the actual death toll from 1991 Iraqi missile strike on Israel were almost five times the officially stated number. Providing such misinformation has even drawn reaction from international rights bodies, with some of them saying official Israeli statistics should be treated with caution. All what it is the fact that the regime in Tel Aviv is very sensitive to acknowledging human losses, so it established a highly disciplined media system completely subject to the army's narrative. Israeli soldiers are said to get used to hearing the phrase, "He completed the mission and returned home safely," a behavior which has become the subject of ridicule for new armed resistance groups, namely the Lion's Den and the Jenin Brigade. They said let the Israeli regime announce its deaths in road accidents, falling from trees and adventures alike. What one would easily differentiate, though, is the cause each side is fighting for. One for the liberation of their land, and the other for occupying the land of others.
Ukraine says that it has repelled another major airstrike on the capital, Kiev, one day after Russia unleashed its largest drone attack on the city so far. Officials said their air defenses intercepted over 40 drones and cruise missiles overnight. No damage or casualties have been reported. On Saturday, a similar volley of attacks killed two people and wounded three others in Kiev. Ukrainian military authorities have counted 15 airstrikes on the city only this month. The intensified fighting in Kiev comes after a lull of nearly 2 months. Main targets are military facilities and supplies. Russia has also warned the West against providing more advanced weapons to Ukraine, including F-16 fighter jets. Belarus says Western countries left it with no choice but to deploy Russia's tactical nuclear weapons, warning the West not to cross the country's red lines on its strategic issues. The State Secretary of the Security Council of Belarus, Alexander Wolfovich, called Russian nuclear weapons on the country's soil strategic deterrence. Recently, Russia announced its decision to deploy nukes in Belarus to counter threats caused by the war in Ukraine. It argued that the West is waging a proxy war to inflict a defeat on Moscow. Russia also rejected the U.S. president's criticism of its decision, saying that Washington must engage in some introspection before blaming others. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said the weapons were already on the move, but it was not clear when they would be in place. It is the first Russian nuclear deployment outside of its borders since 1991. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. Bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. all produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new survey has found that energy rationing has harmed Britain's health. According to this research, poor families used extreme heating methods that compromised their well-being and safety. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to the UK government's advisory body committee on fuel poverty, amid soaring energy prices and growing fuel poverty, UK households rationed heat this past winter, which resulted in 57% of those rationing heat suffering from deteriorating health and well-being. Last winter, energy use was massively rationed across the UK. According to Citizens Advice, in 2022, the number of people unable to top up their repayment meter was more than the previous 10 years combined. The committee, sponsored by the Department for Energy Security and Net Zero, said, as a result, alternative heating strategies such as the use of electric blankets and hot water bottles spiked in popularity. The committee said, in the research, which was conducted by London Economics Limited, the cost of living crisis and concurrent increases in energy costs has led to a substantial increase in the number of households in areas on energy bills, both in gas and electricity. So many people resorted to rationing energy in the UK, and 57% of those rationing fuel, equal to 34% of all adults in the UK, saw negative health and well-being consequences. For older people, 800,000 of over 60s left their homes in January 2023 to stay warm elsewhere. The research showed, of consumers who used less electricity and gas in the winter of 2022 to 2023, who were 60% of adults, 43% were using a tumble dryer less often, and 42% were using washing machine less often, the research found. To alleviate the effects of the cost of living crisis, some fuel-poor households have resorted to more extreme coping strategies to ration their energy use, compromising their health, well-being, and in some cases safety, the committee said in the report. Many households in other countries also struggled to cope with the energy crisis. Just ahead of 2022 to 2023 winter, Germany's insurance industry warned consumers against dangerous experiments to heat amid soaring energy prices. The insurers are concerned that the risk of fire is rising with the use of candles, too many electric heaters, or makeshift fireplaces. Meanwhile, RT reported growing fuel poverty amid surging energy prices forced many households in the UK to resort to energy rationing over the winter, compromising their health and well-being, the government-sponsored Committee on Fuel Poverty said in its report published recently. According to the study, many households could not afford to heat their homes sufficiently in winter, which led to massive rationing across the UK. To stay warm and save energy, people used improvised fuels such as clothes, books, and waste, as well as alternative means of light such as candles, the report revealed. The number of people unable to top up their repayment meters in 2022 was higher than in the previous 10 years combined, as some fuel-poor families self-disconnected, letting energy meters run out, according to the research. The report said the cost of living crisis and concurrent increases in energy costs has led to a substantial increase in the number of households in areas on energy bills, both in gas and electricity. The study added some fuel-poor households have resorted to more extreme coping strategies to ration their energy use, compromising their health, well-being, and in some cases, safety. As a result, 57% of adults who reported having used less fuel felt that having no cutback on heating their home affected their health and well-being, researchers wrote. The report also found out that about 800,000 elderly people across the UK left their homes in January 2023 to stay warm elsewhere. Some 60% of adults used less electricity and gas over the past winter, with 43% of those surveyed cutting down on the use of a tumble dryer and 42% using their washing machines less often, the research found.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the Sultan of Oman, Haytham bin Tariq Al Said, is in Iran for the first time since becoming the leader of the kingdom in 2020. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi had invited him to Iran during the president's visit to Muscat. Now, the Omani Sultan is leading a high-level delegation for a two-day visit where the two sides will discuss expanding relations. Iran and Iman have a history of good relations, and the two sides would like to see their cooperation expanding even more. We will take a look at the significance of the Sultan of Oman's visit at this time on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program out of London, Masoud Shakir, a political commentator. And out of Belgrade, John Busnes, journalist, activist, and political analyst. Thank you both for being with me. Well, Masoud, let's start off with the significance of this visit by the Sultan in your perspective.
Hi, Masoud. This is really a sort of continuation of an extremely good relation, as you mentioned, between Iran and Oman. And reconfirmation of the continuation that good relation by the new Sultan. This is the first time he's coming to Iran and cementing the good relationship between Oman and Iran that goes many, many years. in reality, history of the region has shown that Iran's best relationship in the region has always been Oman, and this has served both the countries and indeed the security and tranquility of the region. So it is significant to see that this is continuing and is being cemented with the new leadership since 2020.
Okay. Well, John, I mean, your thoughts about the importance of this, especially now that the region is experiencing unprecedented levels of rapprochement between various countries.
Well, I think that this is just another step forward from Iran's perspective, and also it's a stabilizing factor in the entire region. So long as Iran can maintain and expand good relations with a growing number of countries in the region, it means that America and its allies cannot pressure Iran to the extent that they used to try to do. This means that there's a greater likelihood of existing and lasting peace, and it's also a greater likelihood of independent economic development for the entire region.
What about that, Master? You heard what John said, that it means that the United States can pressure Iran less. I mean, we're seeing a growing number of countries either expanding their relations with Iran or reigniting their relations with Iran. Let's talk about the significance of this and what's happening currently.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is a number of reasons for this. One is people realizing Iran historically has never invaded any of its neighbors. It's been having a very stabilizing relationship. Even with Iraq after the war, at the time of the Iraq war, Iran did play much better friend and neighbor than all those who were supporting Saddam Hussein for many, many years. So that is historical sort of reality. But also I think there is another reality. People in the region and countries in the region who solely depended on United States are realizing that United States is not a good friend. The United States actually uses and misuses others for its own sort of benefit, short-term benefit or perceived benefit. And greatest example of that is what they did in Afghanistan, what they did in Iraq, what they did elsewhere in the region, and indeed what they're doing in Ukraine right now. Ukraine is almost shattered to pieces because of the short-term political agenda of the United States and expansionist concept for the NATO. So people are actually realizing that if they want security, if they want stability, if they want continuation of their interests and the interests of their nation and their citizens, then they should not be as obedient sort of friend or servant to United States. And that's why we are seeing countries are actually realizing that the only way that they could ensure the security is bypass the propaganda of colonial United States, and indeed sort of trying to establish regional security and regional prosperity economically, politically, socially, and they have a lot more in common. And I think that's one of the reasons we are seeing a shift by Saudi Arabia, Emirates, and everybody else moving away from the United States and trying to be independent because they see no future in being sort of a stooge of the United States. And from Iran's point of view, Iran is holding old allies like Oman on one side and building upon that with the other neighbors, both in the Persian Gulf and also in the north and elsewhere. And I think that is significant.
Okay, well, what about that, John? I mean, what Masoud said is more and more of these countries are becoming aware that the United States isn't a good friend. I mean, how do you assess a country like Oman? Because, of course, Oman has close ties, historically has close ties with Iran. It also is close to Washington. So how is it able to actually balance those two sides and the importance of this?
Well, there are basically two options that are on the table. A, Oman is attempting to be a more independent country and therefore broadening its contacts in the region to balance the influence of the United States, or, which is commonly the case with American allies, America has permitted Oman to have contact with Iran because America itself realizes that it needs more contact with Iran to get itself out of the mess that it has created in the region for itself. Either option is bad for America's hegemony, and we have to remember that it's been said repeatedly that there is nothing more dangerous than being an enemy of America than to be a friend of America.
Yes, yeah, a very well-known quote these days. It's definitely going around a lot. Well, Masoud, Oman has played over the years the role of mediator between Iran and various Western and Muslim countries. What about this particular visit? Do you think that there is any special meaning behind this visit at the time when the situation in the region is changing so rapidly?
There is. I mean, as I said, this current leader hasn't been to Iran before, so it is significant that he is coming. And the fact of the matter that there is the change of the mood in the region. I mean, it's not there was a time that Oman was one of the very few countries in a relationship with Iran, and it was always said that that relationship is being encouraged by United States for having a contact. But we're seeing that is not the case now. There is a much, much better relationship with Saudi Arabia, with the Emirates, with Qatar, and the whole region. And the reality is that those countries, including Saudi Arabia, are refusing to be obedient servants of United States when it comes to the price of oil, when it comes to relationship with Russia. And so it, really the significance of this is much, much greater, much wider than just between Iran and sort of the region. And the fact of the matter is that to build upon the good relationship of Oman and then extend it, which is what the policy has been by this present government of Mr. Raisi, it really sort of shows Iran is going into a different league and the times are changing tremendously.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, the times are changing tremendously. Let's talk about those times, John, because as Masoud's saying, we are seeing a lot of changes that are taking place in the region. A lot of, as I said earlier, rapprochement or attempts at that. One of these is actually Oman is in the middle of trying to initiate or rekindle the relationship between Cairo and Tehran. And just a couple of days prior to coming to Iran, the Sultan of Oman was in Egypt. Your take on that side of things and the importance, if you believe that it is important, of close relations or rekindling relations between these two countries.
Absolutely. And I'd like to agree completely with the comments of your other commentator today that, yes, this is bigger than just Oman. This is actually a global shift as the world moves towards multipolarity, as everybody recognizes that the so-called sole superpower, America, is not the sole superpower, and as the petroleum-producing nations themselves gather around the resource that they have and realize that there are other buyers who do not ask to have sovereignty over your country for dealing with you in business. Now, as this expands to Egypt, and with the role of Oman in Egypt and Iran, we're seeing it move beyond just the countries which are the main oil producers, but to the other Islamic countries in the region. And this means that we've moved beyond the strict economic basis to an actual cultural and political expansion of multipolarity. And I have to say that not many people expected Iran to be able to do this, and this is a feather in the cap of Iran.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about that, Masoud, because from a strategic perspective, when we look at what is happening, again, in the region, and they strengthen the ties with each other, one would think that the country, for example, the United States and its allies that believe in dividing and separating and causing problems, would not be happy about this and likely targeting regional countries to try to change their perspective. Let's talk about that and the possibilities. On the one hand, if these countries have this solidarity, and also the possible problems, the way the United States may target them. How do you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is really one of the dangers. The fact is that the United States is in a process of losing this authority and its power, and superpowers, when they're doing that, they're actually the most dangerous. They see it happening every day, and Egypt is actually a great example of that. I mean, I remember at the time of Islamic Awakening, I went to Egypt four times, and I couldn't even make a phone call from Egypt to Iran. I had to go through a third country, you know, to get connected.
No.
Because it was absurd. And this was the power of the United States trying to divide and rule. And they're extremely, I mean, all the reports indicate that the United States and Israel are fuming over this sort of attempt for the Egypt and Iran to get closer. And this is going to happen elsewhere. So this is in some ways, is very exciting time. And in the same time, is a dangerous time, because mm-hmm. United States is going to use all sorts of tricks to create conflict. And many indicating the sort of the situation of Afghanistan right now is something that behind the scene, it's that divide and rule. And sort of element coming or trying to show its ugly head. So there has to be very careful, vigilant mm-hmm. At the time like this for these countries to move forward positively, becoming closer to each other. But it's going to happen. It's going to happen, and it's continuing to happen. And these hiccups, if they even manage to organize it, are going to be nothing but hiccups. And I see nothing is going to stop this change of mood. And as the other contributor said, it's not just in the region, but it's globally. And it's happening, and it's very exciting.
Right, yeah, not just in the region, but globally. Now, John, what would you say? I mean, because this has been happening over the years, various situations that countries have seen, the hegemon in various wars. But what would you say was the main force behind this change right now? Many would say the situation with Russia and Ukraine, and then the way that the United States and its allies basically had frozen Russia funds, and then more and more countries start thinking, well, it could be us too tomorrow, anytime Washington disagrees. I mean, do you see that as the main force behind all this, or your overall assessment?
Well, I would say that could be called the the final chapter of the development that's been taking place, but we've got two other elements that that actually must have weighed in very heavily on this. We have to recall that there used to be a country or united state called the United Arab Republic, which united Syria and Egypt together as allies and as one functioning state. So it would imply that the growing influence and the great aid that Iran has given to Syria in resisting the ISIS operation run by the United States, the proxy war in Syria, and the effort to topple the leadership of Syria has also opened the door to Syria-Egypt rapprochement. And that's probably taking place under the covers here. And at the same time, Egypt knows the writing is on the wall because of what happened in Libya. So Egypt is seeing itself in a situation where it's looking at its own historic past, its own historic past alliances, and realizing that actually, out of all of this, the one country that has stood still and defended itself and survived all of this is only Iran. So Iran is now building a linkage that ties together Arab nations, that ties together the experience of Libya, and ties together the regional interests of all of the countries around this permanent war zone, which is what America has created with its support for Israel. This is a very, very important strategic step that has at least three factors: Syria, Libya, and Israel all being dealt with and these problems being resolved by Iran's initiative. It is a historic moment indeed.
What about that, Masoud? I mean, at the bottom line, is it that Iran in this 44 years with all of the problems and sanctions and attempted coups and anything we can just about say that existed has been thrown at Iran over the last four decades. And despite this, standing strong, continuing to strengthen, do you think that the regional countries finally got it? Because in the beginning, there was a lot of trying to divide. Of course, this isn't the old English rule of divide and conquer, whether it's between ethnicities, nationalities, religion, whatever. Have we matured in the region enough to get over minor differences, concentrate on what we have in common, and help to improve each country in the region by being strong and by being united? Do you think that we're there yet, Masoud, or how do you see it?
We are in that process. I mean, we talked about how United States cannot be trusted. You know, you look at Libya, you could look at you know, what they did in Afghanistan, and it goes on and on and on, and Ukraine and so forth. And exact opposite is actually the position of Iran's friendship, be it with Syria or be it in Lebanon or be it anywhere else, in Iraq, etc., etc. It's been a friendship, it's been a support, which has been unconditional, and it has been total. And especially, you know, for groups like Palestinians. I mean, the fact of the matter is not based on sort of fecking of being supporting Shias or Sunnis and so forth. People have been supported because they needed the support. That has been exactly in contrast what United States has done. But I think also we need to recognize what happened in Qatar at the World Cup. I mean, there was an awakening. I mean, Palestine and Palestinian cause was the real winner. All these nations, they realized, despite all their sort of spend, despite normalization on the level of the governments and ministers and emirs and so forth, ordinary people right across the region are supporting Palestine even more than what they have done or what they was taught. And I think that was also a wake-up call for these governments in the region, that they can't really go against that sort of popularity for a cause within their own population and try to depend
on Israeli support or U.S. support and so forth. So there is a combination of everything that is bringing that level of awareness that indeed, if they've got even any sort of intellect, they should see that their future and the future of their country and indeed their leadership depends on this shift that has to take place.
And John, we just have less than a minute actually left right now, about 30 seconds. How do you see it with the situation that Masoud had just talked about? Are you optimistic about the West Asian region, the future? How do you see it?
I am very optimistic. You know, I'm a believing Christian. And if you look back 20 or 30 years ago, there would be very few believing Christians who would be supporting unity among Arabs, among Muslims, and so on. But there are so many of us who have opened our eyes, who have seen that this is a perpetual war by a godless America. They don't believe in God. They believe in their warfare and their God, which is mammon. And that is just money. And profit put before people will always result in a collapse. They are on their way down, and the rest of the world is on their way up.
And on that note, I thank both of you being with me on this program. Masoud Chowdhury, pleasure always, political commentator out of London. John Bosnich, wonderful having you as always, out of Belgrade, journalist, activist, and political analyst. And as always, viewers, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering the doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah,
who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Brother Sohail is our special guest speaker for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam, brother. Thank you for to have me here.
One important topic is the concept of ismat or isma, infallibility. Is it possible that, for example, the prophets make mistake because they are called, we can say, they have isma, they are infallible, so they are not prone to make any mistake or any error, even their minds, even the, for example, in the brains or something like that. Talk a little bit about the concept of isma of prophets and then answer this question, that can they do any mistake? For example, unnecessary or important areas in the prophets, infallible imams even.
Okay, so the concept of infallibility of the prophets or the imams or the guide,
yes,
of this world is that when Allah wants to send someone to this world to give hidayah, the person needs to be more aware than the people he's sending to, you see. For if you send a non-infallible prophet, of which the examples we can see between the kingdoms in Islam that took place, because they are kind of Muslim leaders, mm-hmm, around that period, and you have seen a lot of Muslim leadership that are here because of not being infallible, there are a lot of issues that came up. Akhlaqi issues and this. I'm not saying that they are prophets or stuff, but I just want to make you realize that when you have someone who is not infallible, even the best of practices or best of persons, there is some kind of issues that come up. Mm-hmm. Sinning, whether likely or unlikely,
yes,
becomes a part. They become prey to it, you see. Now, a person needs to be a lot of taqwa and have that kind of accessibility to, yes, be able to reach that position. So regarding infallibility, meaning like there's a difference. They can't sin or they won't sin. The question here is saying that can they do mistakes in some unnecessary and important issue? Let's say, can they sin? No. They can sin.
Mm-hmm.
Will they sin? No. To be able to sin, it's a freedom of it's
choice.
Yeah,
freedom of choice and freedom of will, choice. That's right.
So he can, but he won't. Why? Because he has attained the highest marifat of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the existence of this world.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I have the possibility, I can sin. For example, me, as a Muslim, there are a lot of things I'm not allowed to do. I can drink wine. Yes. I can eat pork.
Yes.
Will I?
No.
Why? The simple reason is because Allah has told me not to.
Okay.
You see? For the same thing, because my marifat of Allah is to wine and pork.
Yes.
The Imam's marifat of Allah is in the whole existence.
Mm-hmm.
Because of that, they don't sin. There's a difference between can and will. Can they sin? Yes, it's a freedom of choice. Will they sin? No.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So infallibility comes in this existence.
That's right. But now the main question is that, for example, don't we have any, for example, examples in the life of prophets making any mistake? For example, in the Holy Quran, we have the story of Moses, for example, killing the person. Or, for example, in the lives of all prophets, we have some instances that at least to look to be a mistake. Or it's better to say a kind of error that they have made in their life, in the ordinary life, okay? So how does it...
So,
or is it at all true to say that, for example, the Nabuva and the Isma in the Nabuva is different from the Isma in the general lifestyle of the prophets?
So when we say... because there's two concepts. There's one, you're saying mistake. Do, yes, you determine mistake to be sin?
Mm-hmm.
Like, are we talking about sin? Or are we talking about something that seems to be a mistake but might not even be a mistake?
Mm-hmm.
So if it is about sin, then no. Prophets do not sin. Everything has a kind of explanation to it.
Yes.
So, for example, we know that the for things that are mustahab on us human beings,
mm-hmm.
Do certainly pertain to wajib on the anbiya and imams.
Yes.
One of the examples is namaz-e-shab.
Yes.
Salatul Layl.
Yes.
It's a mustahab act for us, but it becomes a wajib act for the anbiya. We have in traditions that are there. There are things that are not expected out of